That's all I wanted.
That was good.
The Age of Aquarius song is what I wanted to open up with, just because I thought it'd be humorous, but also it's astrologically we are entering the Age of Aquarius. The Age of Pisces is coming to an end, and Carl Jung made a big deal out of this, the fact that the Age of Pisces, which has been symbolized by the fish and Christianity, is now coming to an end. And he thought that spiritually it was a time of movement and development in the human psyche. So he drew on astrology and alchemy, and he made some pretty amazing statements.
I'm sorry, when did the Age of Pisces begin?
March? Around the time of Christ's birth. Yeah, although Jung has an essay, I forget where he deals with it. I think it's in his book Psychology and Religion. I forget the exact spot or exact essay, but he has a big discussion about the images of symbols associated with Pisces and... you know, that the dating, and he goes into this long thing about the dating of when these things started, and there's a lot of variation. So it's not self-evident when the Age of Aquarius is actually starting, or if it's like it's a particular day, or it's a gradual, slow transition. Song says it's the dawning of the Age of Aquarius, just the beginning. And it should last about 2,000 years once it gets rolling.
What does the Age of Aquarius bring?
For you?
Harmony and understanding.
Change.
So it starts on Tuesday. Pisces is fish, of course.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and Aquarius is the water bearer. For Jung, it meant it was part of the evolution, the development of the human psyche. And he saw it as it's a movement that's directed by the unconscious, which is not limited to one's own unconscious. It's kind of like he called it collective unconscious, the objective psyche, yeah.
Pisces ones or Aquarius?
No, just the whole movement.
Oh, okay.
From one to the other. And that's,
okay.
Astrology is a kind of a symbolic language where the unconscious is, the contents of the unconscious are seen as projected out on the stars.
Okay, that's the influence of the stars.
Yeah.
Okay.
You mentioned geometry earlier, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Where does the study of numbers and numerology come into all of this in terms of, was there anybody doing that back then?
Oh, yeah.
So, how did Ficino feel about that?
I don't know.
Did he recognize it? Was it?
I'm sure he did. I mean, he, some of that was more coming from the Kabbalah, Jewish mystic tradition. And I don't know, I didn't read anything that said that Ficino had anything to do with the Kabbalah. Although, you know, very close at his heels, there were people that were doing similar things. Paracelsus certainly knew about the Kabbalah. And so numerology, that would have been there, and, you know, as part of the astrological lore as well.
But the purpose of studying geometry on the way up, if you will, What is it that geometry allows humans to, how does it elevate a human, if you will?
It for example, if you think about what geometry is, if you started to look at this room geometrically, mm-hmm. You'd start to look at lines
and the
planes.
Relationships between those lines and those planes.
Right, and the proportions. So it's a movement, at least this, there's more to it, I'm sure. It's a movement away from sensation to something more abstract and more essential.
What, couldn't you kind of explain it? Like, instead of seeing this as a table, you would see it as a rectangular plane that has, you know, instead of seeing it as common, I guess, what we'd commonly call this a table or a desk, you'd see it as all just geometrical
right.
objects. You'd kind
right.
of deconstruct it.
Exactly. And yet you'd look for, you know, harmonies, like the relationship between the width and the length. Is that done right, in the right proportion, and so on.
And I just saw a show on Nova this last, just 2 days ago, all about, what are the...
Fractals.
Yes. And
fractals.
Exactly. Did you watch it too, Dr. Kittstream?
I saw a movie.
What was
yeah.
it?
I had
fractal geometry.
Yeah, I had lunch with Mandelbrot.
He was a commencement speaker here.
He was.
Yeah.
That was very nice lunch with him.
And I guess when you talked about geometry earlier, I thought about the Nova show that I saw about fractals and harmony, and how that even, there are people that are studying forests and how there are fractals everywhere. It's just incredible.
I think people like Ficino would have just taken to fractal geometry like a duck to water. Because it does show hidden harmonies.
Wouldn't geometry essentially...
Numerology, I don't want to...
Right.
No, go ahead.
Much, but numerology really isn't about geometry and these things. I'm going to talk a little bit about geometry when we get to music.
Okay.
But numerology is about the symbolic meaning of numbers.
Right.
So when Dante uses the number 3 and the number 10, or the number of completion, things like this in the Divine Comedy, that's a form of numerology, where numbers signify something beyond the simple structure and the rest of it. So, and they're sometimes very predictive, like 666,
right.
you know, this sort of thing. So that's what numerology is about. This piece of geometry in Ficino and the Neoplatonist is a very different thing. It's about trying to find the essential form of things.
Yes.
I was just going to say, geometry seems like to me like it would be the connection between the arts and the math, it's kind of like the transition between the two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, leading from the more concrete to the more abstract, yeah. Okay. In the interest of time, just do this. There's just a couple points I want to make on the reading. I'm sorry, but I want to get to Paracelsus too. Here you see about something about the text. It's called a commentary, but it's really more a treatise on love. It was enormously, it was widely used for 200 years. It was like a bestseller among the courtly classes in Europe. If Oprah had been a real princess, this would have been on her bestseller list. Okay. And love is not only love; it pervades the cosmos. Remember, this cosmos is alive. All things are bound together, and seek their source in God through love. Human beings, because of our unique position as the microcosm and as kind of the humans stand on the boundary between the spiritual and the material world. And among the faculties of the soul, the imagination stands in the middle of the soul. And it participates in both the spiritual and the earthly. And for us, love has two sides to it. There's the heavenly Venus and the vulgar Venus. Vulgar doesn't necessarily mean, vulgar means of the people or common, but it also has to do, you might say, with earthly love. Heavenly love leads us back to the source. Earthly love leads us to propagate beauty all over. So it leads to procreation and the manifestations of the beauties of nature. Okay. I'm going to skip a couple here. Yeah, in book 4 of the commentary on love, or the book of love, there's so much that we could talk about, but we don't have the time. But here he gives Aristophanes' myth. And you know the Aristophanes myth, that we're originally these spherical beings and that we were so proud that Zeus cut us in half, and that he threatens if we don't get our act together, he's going to cut us in half again and we'll be hopping around on one leg. That is, of course, the exoteric aspect of this, and Ficino proceeds to tell us what the esoteric meaning is, that these men are souls. This is a way of talking about the soul. And the soul becomes split, becomes divided from itself when it becomes embodied. You know, at the same time he's talking in these terms, he also has a sense of actual human psychological life, because he has this remarkable passage where he talks about adolescence. The bottom of page 73, when souls already divided and immersed in bodies have first come into the years of adolescence, they are aroused by the natural and innate light which they retained to recover through the study of truth, that infused and divine light, once half of themselves, which they lost in falling. He's talking about puberty. And you know, most adolescents aren't going to go for the heavenly Venus. They want the earthly Venus. And so, you know, in a way, there's a vindication of earthly love in this text, as well as heavenly love. He's not a Puritan. He's not a Calvinist. He's not a Jansenist, or an Irish Catholic quasi-Jansenist. There's a real celebration of love in all its forms, because it's all Venus. It's very interesting in that regard. And towards the end of this, he says, you know, our empirical condition is that we don't know who we are. We don't know. We're lost. We're confused. We're in exile. We're restless. And he gives us in this, you know, a path back to our source. But he says in the end, what restores us to heaven is not knowledge of God, but love. Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but I wanted to... I don't know if... Oh, this does not show up at all, does it? Oh, that's too bad. It's a... I'll draw it. This is from Jacques Lacan. It's called The Graph of Desire. This is the graph of desire. And this is the signifying chain. Language, the symbolic order. This is what you have to, this is the child at birth, we'll say. The young infant. Infant means one who has no speech. And in order to become human, you have to become a speaking being. I mean, fully human. You have to enter into speech and become alienated from yourself in a way. So it's like the soul entering the world. So you think of this flipped over, you know, for Ficino, it's like this, except it's more of a completion of the circle, returning to the heavens, coming down to earth. So it's kind of like an inverse Platonism, except for... Lacan, where it ends, you don't come home again, you're the split subject. Zeus has done his work. This is Zeus. He splits you. You're no longer this wholeness that you thought you were. You're now a split subject. It's the Aristophanes myth told in psychoanalytic terms. And this is the, you know, the Oedipus complex. And how does the Oedipus complex work? You're threatened with castration. You'll be cut in half. But it's the only way to become a human being, the only way to become a sexual being. Because if you don't cross that threshold, then you know you're really not in the human order. Anyway, that's just a little aside, but there's that kind of depth in Ficino too. Or you can learn if you have some background in psychoanalysis, you can really enhance it by reading Ficino. Because I think his insights into love in this book, which you read a little bit breezy, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and so on, it can seem, and I think he's sometimes dismissed as a kind of superficial Renaissance philosopher. They really weren't serious. He's not Immanuel Kant or something like that. But there's an enormous amount of depth in this work, I find. Okay. A little bit from this sixth book here. And feel free, if you have any questions, if something's just like burning, you want to ask about one of these chapters, bring it up. I'll try to do what I can with it. And there's the basis for magic in this dial and this speech six as well, because of the way love works. What I wanted to point out is, chapter three, he's talking about the soul of the world and the world body. He gives us on page 110, the soul of the universe must be single, just as its matter is single and its structure is single. Who will deny that the elements earth and water are alive since they give life to the creatures born from them? So this is a world in which everything is animated. Everything has soul. Not in a primitive sense, you might say, but in a highly sophisticated sense. And the way you understand it is through love. The example I'm looking for, page 113. The Venerian daimon is a threefold love. The first is placed by the Platonist in the heavenly Venus, that is, in the intelligence itself of the angelic mind, which would be the world soul. The second is the second in the vulgar Venus, that is, in the power of procreation which the world soul possesses. These two are called daimons for the reason that they are midway between formlessness and form, between earth and heaven. So there's that twofold understanding of Venus, one going up and one going down. And then he has this beautiful depiction of the relationship between narcissism and love with the mirror. Page 114. Therefore, those who, as we have said, are born under the same star are so constituted, in other words, two people born under the same star, are so constituted that the image of the more beautiful of them, penetrating through the eyes into the soul of the other, matches and corresponds completely with a certain identical image which was formed in the astral body of that soul as well as in its inner nature from its creation. The soul thus stricken recognizes the image before it as something which is its own. So the love begins when through the eyes, looking into the eyes of another, an image of the other enters one's soul and one realizes it as something that you are. So it's a relationship of mirroring that's very interesting, that has to do with the beginnings of love. Well, that's what Freud called narcissism. It's not the, you know, you think of, well, love means that you're related to somebody who is wholly other. That's not where it starts, at least not according to Ficino. It starts by this mirroring of image. The soul thus stricken recognizes the image before it as something which is its own. And then so on. And he gives a So he really does give a depiction of some of the complexities of love and how that can be the basis for this move to contemplation. That's a startling thing. This is his teaching on Socratic love. You know, he talks about the contemplative man moves from sight to reason, and the voluptuous man moves from sight to touch. But you know, and then the active man just stays on terms of sight. But there you are, and love moves in both of those ways.
I might insert a quick parenthesis. You may remember in Merchant of Venice, Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice, the song, "Tell me where is fancy bred, fancy means love, or in the heart or in the head, it is engendered in the eye."
There you go.
Straight out of Ficino.
Right. Every love begins with sight. Yeah, it's remarkable. And with the one who is in love, this your vital spirits, in a sense, pour out of your eyes into your beloved. And that's why you become melancholy, lovesick. Because you're literally depleting your own vitality in just, you know, why so pale and wan, fond lover? Why so pale and wan? That's captured also in here. I don't know when that was written. I guess that's later, huh?
1630.
Okay. Yeah. Same story. So, and love is a kind of obsession. I mean, see, so you get there's. It's a very rich. It's not a synthetic notion of love. He doesn't put it all together into some kind of systematic understanding of love. There's all these positions. It's this way. It's that way. And so on, but the there's enormous depth here. Okay. All right. So some of this I've touched on. Love is a magician. The power of magic consists in love. The most important magic is love magic, as everybody knows from Love Potion number 9.
Yeah.
But any kind of magic has to do with love, because it's what draws two things together, what gets at the essence of one object and can transfer to another. I really find this passage on 128 about love being immortal and mortal at the same time. It's brilliant. It's never extinguished, and it changes its object rather than die. So it's immortal. It seeks new pleasures, thus it is mortal. A figure once loved is always loved. It's immortal. And he just plays on these back and forth. And it really just captures something of the dynamics of human desire. And again, the mirroring. You seek yourself outside yourself, O wretch, and you cling to your captor in order that you may sometime ransom your captive self. You know what, when someone, you know, this is like stalking. I mean, there really is a kind of obsessional quality of this, that because it doesn't say anything about what the other person is thinking or feeling at this point. It's just that you cling to your captor. So the one who's doing the clinging, the one who is being, you might say, aggressive, feels like they're clinging because they're trying to capture their self that they see in the image of the other. So, you know, if Hillman's right in one sense. There really is something in Ficino that's a precursor to modern psychology, especially psychoanalytic psychology. Okay. One last thing. Here, this is the other musical one. So I'll have to do the same thing again, unless it won't work. I'm not going to try. This is Venus music.
Thank you. Ah, Venus is twofold. She is both the divine intelligence and the creative power in the universe. Each Venus has the same companion, love. The first is drawn up by indwelling love to contemplate the beauty of God, and the second by the same love to recreate this beauty in material forms. The first enfolds within herself the splendor of God and then sheds it on the second, who imparts flashes of glory to the body of the world.
That's for sure.
Oh, how wonderful is the dominion of Venus and of love. To Venus, we ascribe songs that are full of pleasure and delight, playful yet tender.
Isn't that nice? Yeah.
Actually, it's 14th century music.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
You'll hear some more of that in a couple of weeks.
Good.
Oh, good. Yeah. Anyway, so you can tell here they really tried to create a different atmosphere than the one they had for Saturn. So it puts you in a different mood. Talking about his ultimate mood music, Ficino. Okay, last slide on Ficino here. Renaissance man? Yes. Ficino was convinced he was doing for Plato what Giotto had done for painting and Dante for poetry. So he really saw himself as in terms of bringing a renewal of learning. His influence was wide through his letters and so on. His works, as you can see, were reprinted. Some of the people that were influenced by him, just a few. De Amore read for over 200 years, I mentioned. Robert Boyle and John Locke thought enough of him to refute him in the end of the 17th century. I did not find what refutations they did, but indeed they did. His translations of Plato, again, they were the first ones into Latin. You were in use into the 18th century. I forget, I had read once when the last publication of his Latin translations were. But it was fairly recently. And as you see, only in the 19th century were they superseded. So from the 1480s to over 300 years later, his works on Plato were his translations of Plato were enormously influential. Not too shabby. Anyway, so that's a brief, well, maybe not, doesn't feel brief, but an introduction to Ficino. Now we're turning to, and now for something completely different. Paracelsus. You see his dates here. So Ficino dies in 1499. So Paracelsus is 6 years old at the time of Ficino's death. I started off with his motto because it does suggest to me something of Paracelsus. Let him not be another's who can be his own. And this is some little bit of background. One of his principles was all things are poison, and nothing is without poison. Only the dose permits something not to be poisonous.
All things in moderation.
Yeah, but he's specifically talking about remedies, medicines. One of the things he did was, I don't know if I mentioned or not. Well, we'll get to it. But the way you make the dose was, for him, it was alchemy / chemistry. And he's considered one of the founders of modern pharmacology. So when we get our School of Pharmacy here, we're going to have an annual
Paracelsus
lecture. Here he is. This is apparently taken from a likeness, and this was done during his lifetime, and not the most brilliant of looking of fellows. There's other pictures where he's a little bit more dashing. The one thing I want to point out is what he's holding. This says Azoth, A-Z-O-T-H. He's holding that. Just remember that word, Azoth. We'll come back to that. On the top of this image, you see his motto that I read in English about be your own man. On the side, I think it says, all gifts, all perfect gifts come from God, the imperfect from the devil. He has a very conflicted reputation. Anything you want to say about him, somebody has said the opposite. He's a chemist. He's one of the founders of modern chemistry. No, he was this medieval primitive alchemist. He was a proto-psychologist, a proto-psychiatrist. No, he was some kind of a mystic. He was a successful physician. He actually cured people. No, he was just a loony. He was doing real medicine. No, he was doing spiritual stuff in the guise of medicine. There's more, but those are the ones I found. It's difficult to categorize Paracelsus because the way we divide the world up is different from how his world was divided up. He's often, like Jung sees him as a proto psychoanalyst, a proto psychologist. But the division, the separation of, you might say, physics from psychology did not exist in the 16th century. That's our division, it wasn't his. The same thing with chemistry or with modern pharmacology. Yes, but we don't divide the world up into properties that have specific chemical action and those that have spiritual action. You know, we do divide those things up. So like, you know, at the beginning of the week it was announced that doctors use placebos because we have placebos and real medicine. That dichotomy would not make any sense to Ficino, to Paracelsus. Because what's a placebo? If you take something and it cures you, there's something there. It may not be material, though. It may be spiritual. But, you know, we tend to, you know, there's ethical questions raised about placebos. I was frankly relieved to know that doctors were still doing them. I thought they were so caught up in this autonomy business that they wouldn't do placebos anymore. Anything can be abused. One of the biggest placebos used was antibiotics. Mm-hmm. How many pediatricians have prescribed antibiotics to parents because they're worried about the kid, even though they know the kid does not have strep throat, it's just viral, it'll go away. Shut the parents up by giving the kid antibiotics. Mm-hmm. And we create superbugs. So, why didn't they listen to Paracelsus? So many of the dichotomies, I list some there, science and religion, science and magic, rational Renaissance man versus a 16th century mystic from the Alps, medieval, modern, et cetera, did not exist. They didn't even exist with Boyle and Newton. Somewhat later. Paracelsus is best seen as working within the natural philosophy of the 16th century. And it's largely a Platonic philosophy. I'm not going to go into this whole thing, but one of the images of Paracelsus is of the occult Paracelsus. And that's where our reading comes from, this book, The Hermetic and Alchemical Writings of Paracelsus. This is volume 2, Hermetic Medicine and Hermetic Philosophy, translated by Arthur Edward Waite. It's an incredible two-volume collection of a lot, and it was like some of the first material that was available in English of Paracelsus in the late 19th century. Now, why did Waite translate Paracelsus? Paracelsus was kind of Waite's Hermes Trismegistus. He was funded by a Lord Stafford who was doing alchemical experiments and using up a lot of the family fortune trying to make gold. And one of the texts. So Waite was a spiritual explorer. You know, we tend to think like the New Age, like hair, and the New Age is all this 1960s stuff when family values went to pot in America, literally went to pot. But it's actually part of a much older tradition. Some say it goes back to people like Paracelsus, but at least goes back to the 19th century with Emerson, Transcendentalism, spiritualism in America and in Europe, theosophy. There was an occult revival, especially in Britain in the late 19th century. The Society for Psychical Research was founded. Most of the early psychologists were doing it, psychic research. William James thought it had offered a not. Dr. Dupree's friend Pierre Janet was involved in it. Alfred Binet, who gave us the Binet intelligence test, was involved in this. Jung cut his teeth in spiritualism. It was in his mother's family. They were mediums. That's how we got Paracelsus translated into English. So he was seen as part of this occult tradition. So they in a sense spiritualized Paracelsus. That's what they took from him. Another occult Paracelsus is Jung's Psychology and Alchemy, which we have the text from, some of the text. Alchemy is a form of religious philosophy. Jung was interested in Paracelsus. Jung was not the only Swiss interested in Paracelsus. Paracelsus, we see, he taught in Basel, where Jung grew up. So there's even Paracelsus was from the Switzerland. And Paracelsus is still very much of a culture hero in the German-speaking world. More than I realized, actually. Actually, all I knew of Paracelsus was from Jung, so I had the image of Paracelsus as this very interesting eccentric. And you see have this quote from Jung. The death of all things psychic that took place in scientific materialism was still a long way off, but he prepared the ground for it. He was still an animist in keeping with his primitive cast of mind, but already a materialist. So Jung sees Paracelsus as on the birth of the modern world, right before the scientific revolution. So Jung is in that cast of mind that I was criticizing at the beginning of the class with discussions of Boyle and Newton and so on. He sees Paracelsus as having a primitive cast of mind because he projected the contents of his unconscious into matter. I mean, Jung has more to say about Paracelsus than that, obviously, but another reading of Paracelsus, his work on the minor sickness, the first monographic presentation of the diseases of a definite occupational group, the mine and smelter workers. That's not in this collection. It has been translated, but more recently it was translated by a group of historians of medicine who see Paracelsus much more, instead of like the mystic or the occult figure, as somebody who is breaking away from traditional Galenic medicine of the four humors, the four temperaments, and herbs, to doing something different. Paracelsus used metals in his remedies. And you know, mercury is a poison. But if you get the dose right, then it's not a poison. And the same thing with arsenic and other things that, you know, that Paracelsus was making. Okay. Evidence of Paracelsus today. One thing, Paracelsus dies in Salzburg, Austria. And then you see there, just opened recently, Medical Private University. Paracelsus, Medical Private University, right there in Salzburg. So they named it after him. You wouldn't do that in this country. But, and then the, this is a statue of Paracelsus in Salzburg, where he died, and you can see that he's not presented as some wacko magician or alchemist. He's obviously a very thoughtful man. And this bust is in a German museum. And just the only thing I'll say, it gives his name, and it says physician, natural scientist, and humanist. Brief biography. Born 1493, Switzerland, from the Bombast family. Yes, he was. His son, he was son of a physician. He had a very good early education, mostly under the tutelage of clerics. Worked in the mines. Very practical education in mines and smelters. Mining. Okay, we're talking 16th century mining. I don't know exactly how they did it, but I would imagine it's very dangerous work. But they were also smelting ore and getting the metal out. And so he knew that. That's why he wrote this thing on miners' disease. He worked with miners. He knew what mining was all about. He knew he got in the earth. You see what the earth could produce, these ores. And you had to extract the metal from the ore. How do you do it? Put it in the fire. So it's like alchemy. Or alchemy and smelting are maybe not so different. Maybe these miners didn't talk about arcana and things like that, but they were still doing something very similar. Taking something from the bowels of the earth, this stuff, this dross, and then finding iron, copper, whatever they were extracting in those mines. That'd be a great paper topic. Renaissance mining. If this was Colorado School of Mines, you'd be doing it. Okay. Probably never had a medical degree, but knew medicine. He worked as an army surgeon for a number of years, traveled a lot. He did a lot of traveling. Surgery in the 16th century was not the high-profile profession that it now is. Physic, which is what doctors would practice, I have some pictures. They wouldn't touch that sick person, that sick body with all that stuff. That's what the surgeons did. Surgeons was hands-on. Surgery obviously comes from word meaning hands. It was lower caste. So you would come from a different class of people. Physic, medicine, tends to be more higher class. Not the firstborn son, but maybe the second or the third. Surgery was more, it was for the workers. And workers were low on the totem pole. Paracelsus said, you got to combine them. And that's one of the things that makes him modern, or more for medicine. See, look, he's bringing together medicine and surgery. That didn't happen until the 19th century. When he was at Strasbourg, I have this up here, he couldn't enroll in the Guild of Physicians, so he couldn't, because he didn't have the proper credentials. He was in the Guild of Grain Merchants. But he could practice surgery and so on. He had a rough time with the medical profession because he was so critical of it. It was steeped in Latin learning, in the traditions of Galen, Roman medicine. So in that sense, Paracelsus was not a Renaissance humanist. He was highly critical of the old medicine, of the tradition medicine. He didn't want to go back to the Romans. He thought they didn't know what they were doing. He goes to Basel. He gets a. He's named a municipal physician, which meant that he got that without the credentials. He got that through personal connections. He taught medicine, but not at the university because he didn't have a professorship. He taught in German, not in High German, probably some form of Swiss German. And he criticized the profession. He burnt manuscripts. It's not clear what he burnt. I mean, obviously they were burnt. It was either Galen or Avicenna or both. But he made a public display of that. He had some difficulty with a patient who wouldn't pay him. He sued, he lost, and he had to leave town in a hurry. He was always leaving town in a hurry. The first time he went to Salzburg, he supported peasants in a revolt, and he almost got the death penalty. It did not pay to be a man of the people back then. So he was a barefoot doctor long before Mao Zedong thought of him. Nuremberg, he's treating syphilis. Just arrived from the New World. We brought them smallpox, they gave us syphilis. They found that they could treat it with mercury. Mercury acts as a diuretic, so don't ask me how it works, but anyway, they were treating syphilis with mercury. But mercury is extremely toxic. Alchemically, Paracelsus prepared a medication with mercury in it, so that the dose of mercury was actually very small, and that was successful in treating syphilis. Because you don't need a lot of the matter. What you need is the essence of the stuff, what he called the arcanum. If you can get that, that's what you need. So you can get rid of the body of the mercury. You want the soul of the mercury in your medicine. And that's one of the things he did. And he was very much hands-on. He was making stuff. He was doing stuff. You can see his publications, etc. He was interested in spa waters. He did write... A lot of stuff that he wrote wasn't published in his lifetime, although he did benefit from Gutenberg's press because he was publishing things in German and in Latin. And had enormous following. The Paracelsians were a force to be reckoned with. He had critics, obviously. And he died in 1541. Hospital scene in Paracelsus' lifetime. In the middle, you see these learned men with their long robes. Those are the physicians. You see they're not touching anybody. What they're inspecting is the one in the middle is holding a flask. In the flask is urine.
Yeah, I was gonna say
urine. And they're examining the color and the consistency of the urine to see what, you know, to make a diagnosis. How do you think? But they didn't just look.
They smell.
You know who discovered that the urine of diabetics was sweet? It was a very embodied practice. So you have the physicians there, and then on either side you see the surgeons. The one surgeon on the... this guy looks like he's doing an amputation there. This was a few centuries before ether and chloroform. And then on the other side you see... I don't know, maybe it's Paracelsus. Looks like he's treating a head wound. And you see medical implements around. And in the background, you see a little halo. So it's probably a priest praying for someone who's dying over there in the corner.
If his father was a physician, did something happen to cause him to be in a lower level and not be, or was he just a rebel?
I think he was just a rebel. his father, he did not come from a wealthy family. His father, I think, was the illegitimate son of somebody else, and so they were not, you know, of the upper crust, although he did manage to get a pretty good education. You know, the details of, you know, why he wound up having this course, I don't know, it's very interesting. But he's always on the move, and he took good advantage of that. And he was just at odds with all the established authorities. He criticized, he identified himself as a Catholic, but in one place he criticizes the Lutheran hierarchy as bad as the popes. And he didn't get along with them either. Okay. A Renaissance humanist? Repudiated ancient tradition in medicine. Warred against reason, what he called reason, in favor of parable and analogy. He wrote, he thought that was important, but he also was criticizing his profession for their excessive interest in text and not getting enough experience. One author says that Paracelsus had the most thoroughgoing and insistent exploitation of man, the microcosm, that has existed. Everything that's in the macrocosm is in the microcosm. Everything. Streams, rivers, rocks, trees, birds, everything is in us, spiritually and physically. The sun is the heart is the sun, and so on and so forth. But it's because of that, you can experience a connection with something in the world because it's also in you. Like knows like. Very famous principle. And it was necessary for the physician to understand these things. This quotation: how can a physician hope to know man if he does not know the world, the elements, the firmament? He should study the anatomy of external man, that is, the constitution of the universe, and learn anatomy from astronomy, by which he means astrology, too. Because you can't understand what's going on here without its context in the greater world, and vice versa. So sympathetic attraction, he says, is the key to knowledge. It's through a kind of felt oneness with something that you can know it. You can have the knowledge, and you can get the knowledge in your soul of the knowledge that's in the thing. For example, if there's an herb that causes purging, well, you can know that empirically. Oh, if you take too much of this, it'll give you the runs. But if you want to know its precise action and how it can be used in medicine, you have to know what he calls the science in the thing. And you have to have that in yourself. And in part, it's through this imaginative participation in the world. But it's not something like dreaming kind of poetically or something. It's by exploring it, working with it, bringing it into your laboratory, and so on. And what you're looking for are these. The virtue means power, also called the arcana. They're kind of like the ideas in God's mind. They come from God through the stars. And I like this. The stars didn't create these arcana. The stars cooked them. You know, each star is a little alchemical furnace up there. And it cooks it, and it makes it possible for it to enter the material world. And he saw this as a religious duty, as I have here. The arcana, or the astra, the star in the thing, small and powerful, minute and powerful. Okay, I won't do much of this here. Experience, and I gave the German Erfahrung, because he says you obtain it partly by travel, which is foreign in German. So that play works good if you have the German there. He was not opposed to experimentation, so he was doing experimental work. But that doesn't give you essential knowledge. Oh, you discover something. Oh, what a great idea. What does it mean? It says only when you overhear, that's a technical term from him, from the object, the knowledge it possesses, does one have knowledge. So there's something else that has to occur. And that's through the action for Paracelsus of the imagination in us, which has to be ordered, not your wild imagination, but your imagination ordered in connection with the stars. The human mind has strata deeper and more powerful than reasoning, and by means of them, a man can become one with anything. So it is kind of like Jung's collective unconscious, except that if you explore those depths, you understand the real world of nature. So it's like Jung minus Immanuel Kant, because for Jung, we can never know things in themselves. We only know things as they're filtered through the psyche. We can never get to things as they are. Paracelsus wouldn't have bought that. No, you do know things as they really are. Briefly, magic reveals the hidden virtues of nature. The one thing, magic teaches the physician through sympathy, a knowing of the correspondences. Now, the next thing is important. Magic teaches specific action. It's not like, well, you use this herb because it causes purgation. Well, no matter what the situation, if you want purgation, you use this. No. You want the specific action for the specific disease, for the specific person at this specific time. Specificity. You know, and that's one of the calling cards of contemporary medicine.
Yes.
Specificity of action. You know, a drug has a specific action. And that's what we look for. And Paracelsus was looking for that too, which is very different than Galenic medicine, which looks more for general. You know, you have something hot, so you need something cool. Stars. Disease. Disease comes from outside the body. Disease was not an imbalance in the humors for Paracelsus. Disease comes from a specific source. We don't know what it is, but it has a specific source, and you can identify it. You can see where it is where it's located in the body, as long as you look for its correspondence in the macrocosm as well. And here's our zodiac men. I promised zodiac men. Here it is. The correspondences between the zodiac and the parts of the body. They're two different ones, but they have the same correspondences. It is often pointed out Pisces is the feet. And say, well, that's weird. Fish don't have feet, but there's two of them. So maybe that's why. Scorpio is the genitals, and you see Aries on the head.
Sagittarius.
Taurus, the neck. What's that? What is it?
The Sagittarius is the hips,
the
archer.
Oh, the archer. That's right. Yeah.
The scales.
Yeah.
Libra.
Leo. Leo, the lion, the heart, solar plexus, Cancer up here, and Gemini on the shoulders and the arms. So if you want to study anatomy, go ahead and study anatomy, Paracelsus said. You got to study this too. There's the quotation, I have it here someplace. Jung quotes Paracelsus, that an anatomist looking at the body is like a peasant trying to read the Bible. They just don't know how to do it. They open it up, I don't know what it means. You have to have the right faculties, right? Okay, now we're getting into the material that's covered in the reading. How to produce a medicine that works. This is the alchemical medicine. You make something more powerful by removing the earth from it. Okay? Go home and do that. It's not the herb that heals, but the astra or arcanum in it. And so you can make a drug, an arcanum, or you can perfect it. It's there in nature, but you have to perfect it. You know, in the reading, he compares alchemy to cooking. I mean, you wouldn't just go home, most of you, and just like, oh, I'm hungry, here's a steak. Just eat it raw. It would give you indigestion because you'd make your stomach work so hard. So you use an external stomach called an oven. And you pre-digest it in the heat. And then you eat it, and it's easy to digest. Well, it's the same with medicines. You know, the physicians, he says, they don't know what they're doing. They have all this raw, uncooked stuff. And it has to be volatilized. It has to be spiritualized. And then you have to know the right drug for the right situation, etc. We won't have time to go into all this. These are the three principles that compose everything. Sulfur, salt, and mercury. They're not only the three materials, elements that we talk about. There are as many sulfur, salt, and mercuries as there are objects. Sulfur is the principle of combustion and organization. Sulfur of mass and solidity. Mercury, principle of activity and fluidity. Nothing in nature is simply material. It's also astral. Everything has its own astral body. He is not living in a dead universe. Everything is alive. Everything has this spiritual essence. So when he's in the laboratory, you know, and you take some metal and you put it in the furnace, and you see the colors change. Those colors are extremely important. What colors are they? What shapes do you get? What kind of smoke? What kind of residue? It's a very sensuous kind of praxis that he was engaged in. And you'd have the smells and the tastes and the sounds and everything. That's the spirit of sulfur. That's salt. At least one. I couldn't find a really good one like the other one. As the Ouroboros, the snake swallowing its own tail. That's solid. And there's mercury. Not the mercury we expect. It looks more like Venus.
Yeah.
This is the anima, the soul of mercury. But mercury was very mercurial, so it didn't always appear as a guy. But this is the most spiritual of the three. Activity, fluidity, because you know mercury is liquid too. And the azoth. Remember I told you had the azoth? Here it is. It's sulfur, salt, and mercury combined into one. I don't know who did this picture. I mean, it's kind of corny. It looks like a weird Thanksgiving chicken or something, a turkey. But it's the unity of those three principles. And so it would be something that you might call a panacea, a cure-all. And that's what he has. So it's kind of like the philosopher's stone, if we can get those three together. Okay, well, to wrap this up, there's a lot here. The imagination is a central, I think Jung is right, you have to really understand the imagination or understand Paracelsus. As all heaven is nothing but imagination, it acts on man, causes plague and other diseases, not through bodily instruments, but through its form, as the sun kindles fire. So the imagination acting in us is not simply a faculty for moving images around. It's a formative principle that we participate in.
It's hibernating.
Oh. Am I going to wake it up?
Yeah.
It's okay.
Is it okay?
Yeah.
All right. That acts in us and is influenced by the stars, but also we influence the stars. That's one of the things that Paracelsus points out. We influence the stars so that the imagination of fright can produce plague by influencing the stars and setting up the right astrological conditions for the plague. The imagination is the star in man. The star in man. It was a physical activity. Imagination was a physical activity that could be fitted into the cycle of material changes that brought these about and was brought about by them in turn. That's from Jung. It can really affect the other. If we have sufficient faith, our prayer can make people crooked or lame and convert natural into supernatural disease. Not a pleasant thought. But the fact is that the imagination has that potential for misuse. The more a person is given to speculation, the more powerful is his imagination. Okay. That's about all. Stupid, this disappeared.
Would that play into why placebos work?
Yeah. Because the power of the imagination is there.
You think you're being cured, and so therefore you are.
Right.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's the essential Paracelsus.
Thanks. In a nutshell, right?
In a nutshell.
And I'm particularly grateful because I didn't want us to get out of the Renaissance without seeing this very, very important aspect of it. So often you don't hear about any of these things because, well, they're not serious, right?
Right.
But this is very serious indeed during this period. This is the way a lot of people thought. So we need to know about it. And moreover, we probably still need to know about it anyway.
Yeah.
So we need to be reminded of it. Oh, also, you might go back when you get a chance and reread that essay on Botticelli and Ficino. Might make a little more sense to you now.
Oh, is that the one where he talks about Primavera?
Yes.
I have to read that myself. Yeah.
And then we can get the PowerPoint presentation.
We'll put it.